bantering. We never know when he's actually going to cut it into the show.
Is my hair good?
Right, I've been waiting months to say this. His Royal Highness William, Prince of Wales.
Prince of Wales. I like that. I'll take it. Thanks, Duncan.
HRH.
Done.
Good. At least your name isn't Charles, otherwise I might be calling you.
Something else.
Something else. But
Prince William, Prince of Wales. I like that.
William, Prince of Wales.
Prince of Wales. All right.
His Royal Highness. How are you, sir?
His nibs. I'm very good, Duncan. Good. All the better for seeing you at this illustrious occasion of our first episode.
Very nice to see you. Yeah, it's... We did season zero, and it's made it all the way somehow, by hook or by crook.
Lurching from one season from one to the next, absolutely.
Season one, episode one, and there is so much going on.
We've got a lot to cover.
We have a heck of a
lot to cover.
I don't even know where we're going to start, but we have to start somewhere. And yeah. You've just come back from a place that used to be called Port Elizabeth.
Quebecha. I can't get the click right, so I'm not even going to attempt here.
But that was the location of SA Auto Week, which is motoring industry in South Africa's biggest annual event, arranged by NAAMSA, which I think is also now known as the Automotive Business Council.
Something along those lines.
They call themselves NAAMSA, the Automotive Business Council, something like that. How was the show?
It was very interesting. As we said in the preceding episodes, our pilot episodes, that this is probably the most important one we've had, and it didn't disappoint. Mm-hmm. It definitely is the most important one we've ever had, because it is very much a case of the swords are now drawn and people are starting to hack each other apart in this glorious blood fest in the fight for the consumer of South Africa, the motoring public who's going to be buying cars going forward. And there's a tremendous sense of the pressures that were sort of making their presence felt when the Chinese first started arriving now being brought about to bear. And we are seeing the effects of that on our OEMs. And you can see that there are a lot of worried people floating around. And when one looks at the underlying sort of current of events, not necessarily what's said on stage, but more importantly, what's not said, it was very interesting that I did not hear the word AGOA once.
Interesting.
Not once.
Interesting.
So it's almost as if that's already been baked into the cake and discounted. The word Chinese and job losses and threats for local production, deindustrialization, those are all words that were bandied about like they were cotton candy. And that's not the sort of constructive language we like to hear in a country where we need to move forward in terms of developing our OEM sectors.
So anyone who's kind of missed what's happening in the global world of motoring at the moment, there's a price war of epic proportions going on in China, where there are hundreds and hundreds of brands, many of them in the EV space.
There's 160 different independent manufacturers
in China.
So it's manufacturer, someone who actually makes a vehicle from start to finish.
Yeah.
So it's not sustainable. Yeah. You know, they've got close on 60% of their capacity being used. You've got between 40 and 50% sitting idle, not being used.
And they're killing each other.
Exactly. And
a very, very competitive market. And the Chinese Premier Xi Jinping has even come out and said, "Guys, you need to stop clubbing each other."
Exactly. And pare it back a bit, because I mean it's borderline ridiculous. We've got another three brands. Chinese brands coming to South Africa in the next few weeks.
Well, this is what's happening. They've been told by the Chinese government, guys, go and fight overseas. Stop fighting here in China. So they're all internationalizing and they all see South Africa as a...
And they're all coming here.
They're coming here because they see Africa.
Well, they can't get into Europe all that easily. They certainly can't get into the States all that easily.
Can't get into the States at all.
So where they've got Africa and they've got South America, you know, and that's it. I mean, I suppose you could go and sell some in Antarctica, but penguins aren't particularly good at driving cars.
There's a few Aussies as well.
And some Australians. So you're seeing this play itself out in real time in front of our eyes. And that's where the interesting things start to emerge. Cherry's talking about manufacturing in South Africa, and I need to touch on manufacturing because actually Andrew Kirby mentioned it in one of his presentations, and he mentioned it not once, not twice, but three times. So this is important. When that man speaks, we need to listen. And he said that for every one SKD job you create,
SKD,
you lose 7 CKDs. Now, SKD is a semi-knockdown. CKD is a complete knockdown. It's two types of manufacturing for vehicles.
Okay.
If you have a complete knockdown, it means you're getting all your parts locally made.
Okay.
You're pressing your own panels, you're making your own headlights, you're making your own engines, you're making your own rubbers to go onto the tires that go onto the vehicles. You're making pretty much everything locally that then gets assembled into the car.
Mm-hmm.
In an SKD, you're importing all those parts and you're just bolting them together in a factory, which is kind of like what Bike does in that factory of theirs down in PE.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't want SKD manufacturing here. We want CKD manufacturing here because that's where all the value is created within the local ecosystem. So the issue I have with Cherry coming and manufacturing is that I think obviously they're going to start with SKD and then transition hopefully into CKD as they build the ecosystem around the parts supply. Because remember, you know, if you're a Toyota or a VW or a BMW, you're not producing all those parts and components yourself. You're mm-hmm. buying them from your ecosystem that you spent decades putting together that's supplying specifically you.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, we were down there at a plant where they assemble wiring harnesses.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an independent assembler that manufactures wiring harnesses for the Polo. Only the Polo. An entire factory, 600 people putting together wiring harnesses. I've never seen anything like it. It's incredible. Mm-hmm. It's so much fun. I love that kind of stuff. But it's each wiring harness is unique to the car that's being produced on the assembly system. So you know you've got to be able to assign that wiring harness to that car at that point in time on the production line. It's the complexities of manufacturing cars are enormous. So Cherry are not going to be able to do that immediately. Mm-hmm. I suspect they're going to do an SKD type application and then hopefully build the ecosystem into it. Where I have the issue is why would you do that when you have so much surplus capacity already in China?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not entirely sold on the story, but they're doing the initial feasibility studies on it, which is great. It's what one needs to do: start with the feasibility, see where all the things are, and if their ambition is that they're going to expand into Africa, then it does make sense to an extent. And obviously it comes down to cost.
Yeah.
What can we produce for here locally versus what can we produce for in China?
That, of course, is the real worry, that our local OEM manufacturing base is going to be decimated as the Chinese flood the market with low-cost vehicles, and then they don't follow that with building infrastructure of their own. It continues just to be a supply from China.
Exactly. And I've called it death by a thousand cuts. Mm-hmm. And so you start to see ArcelorMittal closing. That's a fairly significant cut. You know, you start to see
it's like a leg off.
Well, it's a fairly significant cut. You nicked an artery there, you know. Slow bleed out. And this is what we're seeing. And as long as we lag in policy, and we'll touch on this later on in the episode when I talk to Andrew Kirby about it. We have an interview with him coming up that is a must watch. Mm-hmm. It's
stay tuned, folks.
Stay tuned. It's coming up. But what's interesting about that is that, you know, so you get this, you're getting this perfect storm creating where everything is now stacking up against you, and you must remember that our local OEMs are attached to much bigger motherships that sit overseas.
Mm-hmm.
So Toyota doesn't run from Toyota South Africa; it's an independent company, but it very much reports to Toyota Japan.
Mm-hmm.
So Toyota Japan say, "All right, well, you know, we can make Corollas and Hiluxes from Thailand cheaper,
mm-hmm.
and land them in South Africa cheaper than you can make them here." Because now you're importing all your steel and all that stuff, you know, sort of stuff. That could be the decapitation. So it's what we need to avoid. And that's part and parcel of the policy, you know, with the transition to NEVs.
Mm.
Very much a big, big topic at NAMSA. You need to be able to have your domestic market there to support that transition.
Mm.
And it's just not there yet because we have silly policy around import duties on EVs.
On EVs. But hang on a second. At the NAMSA conference last year, President Cyril Ramaphosa got up, made all sorts of announcements about new policies are coming. We're going to subsidize EV sales for consumers. We're going to et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Has anything come of that?
So you know I have a blind spot when it comes to politicians. I accept that and I acknowledge it. And the simple fact of the matter is that on our agenda that changed literally on a daily basis, none of them actually bothered to pitch up.
Mm-hmm. At the event. This year's
the event.
Okay. So, wasn't Parks Tau there?
Well, yeah. The interesting person to listen to was actually Irving Jim.
Oh, right. The unionist.
And when you are sitting in a room agreeing with a unionist, you know the
jig is
up.
William, especially you, William.
You know the jig is up. You're kind of like,
what was Mr. Jim saying?
What have we come to? He was actually talking a fair amount of sense about policy change and why we need it in place. I'm afraid Mr. Tao left me cold. It was more of the same. And, you know, the ANC politicians, in fact, all politicians, lump them all into the same thing. Are great at talking, very bad at implementing. Mm. And the time for implementation has...
It's 5 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. And now it's scramble time. And whether we have enough scramble time to be able to pull the pan out of this particular fire remains to be seen. I'm not particularly optimistic, but that's my job. I'm here as a permanent pessimist. So I look eternally to be surprised on the upside, which will make me happy. Yeah. It may yet happen. I mean, we've got brilliant people in our OEMs. We've got a brilliant industry that's resilient. Mm-hmm. It's been around for a long time. It's fought a lot of odds. It's fought a lot of battles. Mm-hmm. And I hope it survives this one because it's in the fight for its life now.
Yeah, good. Good. We're going to cover some more of SA Auto Week in episode 2, but I think let's not spend the whole of our first episode chatting about
all doom and gloom.
Indeed, we don't want to be slashing our wrists before the episode. Am I allowed to say that before the episode is done? So let's move rapidly along and look at some more.
Let's look at the happy stuff.
The happy stuff. Yes. So Volvo has just claimed, if I can find a picture. Here we go. That's a nice looking car.
I like the color. It's orange. It's kind of like our logo.
Matches the new iPhone.
Yeah, stunning color.
They've claimed that the first car, I have my doubts about this.
First EV.
The first EV, yes. Yeah. I still have my doubts about that, but anyway.
Yeah.
The first EV to successfully summit Sony Pass.
Well, you know, if you claim it, sometimes it's yours. So maybe they are.
I happen to have done Sony Pass about 10 months ago in my great big hulking 4x4.
Yes.
And it handled that pretty well. But I was thinking when I was going up there, I'm really glad I'm not driving this in a regular car, even though there were taxis going up, minibus taxis going up and down the mountain all the time.
You just say regular car.
Taxis go anywhere.
Taxis go anywhere, exactly.
Although those were actually specially imported 4x4 Toyota minibus taxis from Japan. I think we might have spoken about it in a previous episode, actually. But this is not technically a 4x4. I think it's an all-wheel drive. But yeah, you're right, William. The color's beautiful, and it's a very nice-looking car. It is a little bit overpriced, though.
1.1 million or something.
Just over 1.1 million.
This is the EX30 off-road version.
Cross-country, I think they call it.
Mm. Yeah, so it's got a little bit of a higher ride height and some other bits and bobs on it that allow.
I like the LED floodlights at the top of the windscreen there. Yes. They more look like they belong on a Jeep or something. Yeah, exactly.
Or Landy. Yeah. So what's interesting about that is I think the concept behind it is really interesting. Is one where they are taking on the range anxiety thing and sort of tossing it out the window because this is this is exactly the sort of market in which you want range because you're going to exotic places and all over the place. And I think the point that Volvo are making is that, you know, when it comes to actually being able to charge your vehicle, it shouldn't really present a problem, which is a nice segue into our next segment about this little announcement from BYD that they made recently.
Yes.
Coming up. But it's the charging network.
Yes, I was very fortunate to have an interview with Stella Lee, who's basically the number two at BYD globally. She may still be running the North American operation, but she's also in charge of global expansion for BYD. She's been there since the beginning, worked her way up, and she's effectively the number two.
This is a heavy hitter.
Very heavy hitter. Which makes it all the more surprising that she's in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
She was here for a couple of days to make a very important announcement, and that's that BYD is going to roll out as many as 300 megawatt-scale charging stations. I'm sure not all of them will be that speed, but across South Africa.
Just let's remind everyone what a megawatt charging station actually is. Okay, so the biggest that I've charged at recently is a 250 kilowatt. Mm. A megawatt is 1,000 kilowatts.
Four times
the size. This is the one that charges an empty vehicle from naught to full in under 2 minutes or 3 minutes or whatever may be.
Yeah, they claim you get about 400 kilometers of range in about 5 minutes.
It's off the clock. That's if your battery management system on your car can actually handle that.
And there are very few that can do that.
There are very few that can do that. But the point of the matter is that if you've got 10 cars plugged into that thing, they can each charge at 100 kilowatts. Yes. I mean, so that's not just a little statement. It's earth-shattering in terms of the South African landscape, and it's going to change. There you go. It's going to change the face of our EV infrastructure forever. And you know, when you look at it, and you're thinking we've got 5,000, 6,000 last count EVs in total in fleet on the roads at the moment, out of 13 million vehicles we have on South Africa's roads. Why are they doing it?
What are they seeing?
What are they seeing that we're not? And I know the Chinese play a long game.
But I think that's exactly what's going on.
This has got to be the prime example of the long game that they.
But hey, here, BYD, and
plugging it in. And
interesting question,
we're happy.
The interesting question is, will you be able to charge non-BYD vehicles at these charging stations? And that question is not clear yet.
Oh, really?
In China, these flash, they call them flash charging stations.
Yes.
Only BYD cars can charge there at the moment. There's talk about bringing in interoperability and talking to other vendors. But right now, in China, if you go up to one of these 1 megawatt charging stations, you can only charge a BYD there.
So that's very interesting because, you know, if you compare that with the supercharger network, Tesla's.
Yes.
That's open. Multi-platform.
Okay.
So, you know, Tesla's now vending electricity to anyone who will buy it off them, so which is clever. I suspect that they would probably be forced into being
multi-OEM.
Yeah.
Makes sense for them too.
Absolutely.
At the end of the day.
Absolutely.
But it's a good way, a clever way of saying, well, BYD's here for the long haul, and we're putting in 200 to 300 high-speed charging stations. You know, if you want to think electric car, we're here.
And if you worry
Tesla
about
– Tesla isn't.
If you ever worry, well, you're right. I did hear the word yet somewhere down at Nomsa, but I'm not going to describe anything to that until we actually see what happens. But it's certainly a commitment to the BYD presence, I think, that is quite remarkable.
Yeah. It's land grab stuff.
It's quite remarkable.
It's land grab stuff. This is coming to a market early. Let's grab it before our competition does.
Well, I think you're spot on. Mm. I think you're spot on.
But the rate at which they're introducing new cars is quite astonishing. They just announced the BYD C-Lion 5 this week is coming to South Africa. It's another one of these ones, I think, running on this EDMI platform that they use, this hybrid, plug-in hybrid drivetrain that they've developed. Mm. But it's going to come in, I think, around the 500,000 to 550,000 rand price point. This is for a PHEV.
Starting to get there.
It's getting there.
And I mean, so in conjunction with that is the new Surf, which is out.
The Dolphin Surf.
Dolphin Surf.
Which has another name in other markets, I think.
It does have another name in other markets. They call it the Dolphin Mini. Here it's called the Dolphin Surf.
Why they did that.
And appropriately enough, we were in Dolphin Bay with it at launch, which I thought was quite
nice. Oh, you went to the launch,
quite
of course.
Nice. Yes.
So tell us about it. Tell us about the Dolphin Surf. I mean, there's a lot of interest in this vehicle because it's cheap.
Exactly. Mm. Well, relatively, you know, just under 400 grand for the big
330.
330 for the entry-level one. Mm. But that's not all, Duncan.
That's not all.
You also get your charger and you get a 10,000 rand rebate for the early adopters and. You know, so there's another 20 or 30 grand worth of value that they've just chucked into
the Chinese love doing that.
Into the deal, to make it.
When you buy their phones as well, you get this and this, and have a smartwatch, have a tablet.
Along with your phone. Yes. It's kind of like, I bought a smartwatch. Well, you have a tablet and a phone with that. You know, it's buy one, get one, get it all. So it's an interesting way of getting into the ecosystem. Mm. And by
let's get the Surf on the screen.
By all accounts, when I drove it down there, it's about the size of a Swift, maybe a little bit smaller than a Swift, but it feels bigger. It's typically Chinese. You know, when you sit in the back, there's a lot of space. The boot is shopping sized.
Oh, yeah.
But
because that's where the battery is, right?
Well, exactly. Yeah. For what it is, for a city runaround, which is what it's going to be used for, it'll get up to 130-ish on the highway, 140 if you really find
car.
It downhill, which is fine. Mm. You'd want something that'll do 120 on the highway in South Africa. This is just even for a city car.
And you'd leave a Jeep Wrangler in the garage and drive this around during the day.
And that's what's going to happen. Mm. That's exactly what's going to happen. And it's certainly nippy enough and perky enough that you're not going to feel that you're wanting it from a lack of power point of view. And it is slick, modern, and it looks the part, you know.
Is this going after the Suzuki Swift? I mean, who's the competition here?
Well, Suzuki Swift is still 100 grand cheaper, obviously.
Right.
But you know, the
but a Polo? Would this go after a Polo?
I think so.
Okay.
You know, so it's you'd look at this and you're thinking, this is actually really quite an interesting little vehicle. Mm. It's going to be one of those things that I think will go one of two ways. They're either going to sell them by the squillion, or they're going to sell a few and then sell them by the squillion. Mm. You know, so I think there's an interview with Steve Chang that I did down there. It's coming up. I asked him about
I think it's in a future episode.
It might be in the future episode. But in it, he was talking about the barriers to entry for people to buy EVs. Mm. One of them was the charging infrastructure. Tick, done.
Yeah.
Next barrier to entry, price.
Yes.
This one, tick, done. You know, so, and if we do get policy that aligns with trying to develop an NEV market in South Africa, that pricing will continue to drop. Mm. And so, yeah, and I have to say that in this lime green, yellow, I don't know what color you'd call it.
Avocado.
Really, it's really quite nice.
Yeah.
You either have that or a white one.
Yeah. What's the range on them?
Now you've got me on the spot. I think the small one is about just over 250 km,
okay,
and the big one is 350.
So you don't drive it to Cape Town.
You're not going to drive it down to Cape Town, but I mean, you know, you could. Once the infrastructure's in place, you certainly could. So it's a really interesting little vehicle.
I think they're going to sell a lot of these.
I hope so, because it's at the right pricing points. It's the first sub 400K car in South Africa. It's an EV.
But your traditional your Suzuki's, your Fords, I don't think Ford's really in that space at the moment.
Not anymore.
So your Toyota, VW Polo, the Toyota competes, I suppose, with maybe even an entry-level Corolla Cross. Maybe that's a bit
higher. Well, certainly
a Starlet or one of those types of vehicles.
Exactly, Starlet, yeah.
But those Western OEMs, if I can call them that, are going to have to come up with up a response
gun
to this.
They're going to have to up their
quite gun quickly.
And we'll see. You know, it's a game. Mm. Hurry up and wait. But I think it should do well.
Yeah.
It should do well.
Good. Now, we actually do have a lot of interviews lined up in this season.
I've been busy.
You've both been very busy.
Talking to people.
Exciting interviews coming up, but we're going to cut away to a quick interview now that you did, I think, at SA Auto Week, or it may have been at a different event with Bridgestone. I think it was a different event, actually.
So it was a different event.
You were in Cape Town for that one.
That was
an interview with Jacques Ricozza. What were you chatting to him about?
So Bridgestone have released a new tyre, ATS-002, which replaces the ATS-001.
All right.
Go figure.
I know nothing about the world of tyres, so please enlighten me.
So it's an all-terrain tyre. So in essence, it's the tyre that you put on your SUV when you think you're going to be going off-road, mm-hmm, but never do.
Mm-hmm.
So it's
most of Santon.
Yeah, well, exactly. So it's not a full road-going tyre, but it's also a semi-off-road tyre.
Useful when you're mounting the pavement.
100%. 100%. And it's one of those that has they've reworked it. They've remade it. It's completely made here in South Africa, in Brits. So it's a completely
Brits.
In Brits. Okay. It's a locally manufactured tyre. So, you know, we did ask, I think I touched on it in the interview about the impact of Goodyear. But doesn't really seem to affect Bridgestone too much. They've got good OEM relationships, and this is why we talk about preserving our OEMs. You have this big ecosystem around our OEMs that's really important, you know, to far-off places like Brits.
Mm-hmm.
So the tyre itself is said to add an extra couple of thousand Ks per set, which is really good, and pricing is no more expensive than the previous one.
Mm.
So it's looking like a win-win-win for everybody, yeah.
Okay. How big is this tyre?
Any size you like. So whatever.
Okay.
It's not just one tyre. They do make tyres in different sizes to fit different vehicles. So yeah, there's the full ranges.
I think our hardworking production editor over there, Tadek, has got some footage for us. Shall we watch?
Cool. Let's.
I'm here this afternoon with Jacques Ricotta from Bridgestone.
Awesome. It's a pleasure to have you.
CEO.
I am glad to be with you.
No, well, thank you for having us. It's been an awesome event launching your new tyre.
Yeah.
But for our viewers, I want to get a little bit more into the detail of who Bridgestone is.
Yeah.
So you run a manufacturing facility outside of the run of the norm in Brits, of all places.
Exactly.
You guys manufacture around about 1.2 million tyres per year.
Yeah.
Is that about right?
We've got a capacity of 1.6, actually.
Yeah.
But in a normal year, we run around 1.4 million tyres. We'd love to get to 1.6, but as the market dictates.
Where do you sell those tyres to? Who's your biggest customer?
We've got, I'll call it four big groupings of customers. One is the OEMs, your local tyre assembling companies like Toyota, Mercedes-Benz.
Okay.
They take a big share of our volume, say about 30%. The second big grouping is our local replacement market, which is what goes in the retail phase in the local environment. The third place is where we supply to the OED. These are the OEMs shops,
like
your Mercedes-Benz shop itself, the Mercedes-Benz shop itself. Okay. So this is a third group. And the last group is exports. So we export about 25% of the tires that we manufacture locally, which is a very strong base.
So you're manufacturing, so if you're exporting 25%, you're selling about 75% into the local market.
Yes.
That's massive.
Yes, that's big. Really massive. It's a big dependence on that, yeah.
Okay, well, that's cool. How many people do you employ in the country? It's a hot topic at the moment.
No, it's a big one, and I think it's something that we track, and we love it to see it grow.
Yeah.
We employ just about 1,170, let's say 1.2.
Okay.
1,000 people directly.
Okay.
We've got a retail network through the Super Quick, which is owned by our partners in terms of our customers who run the whole Super Quick network. That on its own employs another sort of 7,000 people.
Wow.
Owned by the small businessmen who operate the Super Quicks.
It's a classic manufacturing thing, isn't it? Yeah. You have the direct jobs, but you have all the spin-offs in the ecosystem
that
contribute into that.
Exactly.
And that's why we're so interested in our OEMs and why we value them so highly. And we don't want to see the shenanigans going on like we're seeing at Mercedes-Benz and so forth. In terms of just the overall market size, what is your market share roughly, more or less? I'm not going to hold
you
to it. I'm just curious.
You know, you look at about 12% in terms of the total market share. We break our market into two main segments, perhaps three, but let's talk about two. We call it tier one and two, mm-hmm. which we sort of group together, mm-hmm. and then tier three. Tier three means all, I'll call it low grade, generally import tires. So if you put all those tiers between tier one, tier two, tier three, we are about 12% of the market in total. But if you exclude tier three, which is a market that we don't compete in, our product is not of the grade compared to tier three. So we generally don't compare with tier three. So if you look at tier one and two, between our two brands, Bridgestone as well as Firestone, which is our tier two brand, our market share will be just about 28%.
Okay, so that's significant because you are Bridgestone is a premium brand, so you're not competing for the entry level.
No.
Cheap and cheerful Chinese made stuff.
yes,
we're going to go there. I mean, we have to talk about the Chinese.
For sure.
I mean, it's something that's coming. It's something that's a process in development.
Yeah.
It's changing markets. We've seen it on the cars.
Yeah.
And obviously, everything that's associated with cars is going to be affected by how things are changing and how rapidly they're changing.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a case of, this is why I find manufacturing so interesting, because it's a large business. You're producing 1.4 million tires a year. That's just picture that as a pile of rubber somewhere. It's enormous. So there's scales here that come into play. It's a big operation.
Yeah.
So when you're plonking down the investment into the factory to manufacture your new ATS-002 Mark II of the Duna, the tooling changes and things that go into that are significant investments that I guess you guys have to take a long-term view on in terms of when are you going to get that tooling money back?
Exactly.
And what is the impact going to be when you have competition now entering into your market that now is going to come up against your dealer eventually, I think.
Yeah.
You see that as something coming in the future from the Chinese?
It is. It's already playing out now.
Yeah.
In a sense that what you see is that the market is actually growing.
Mm-hmm.
In this country, we sell about, let's say, a million tires a year. And what you see that market is growing. So maybe it's growing about 2.5% a year from a tire market point of view. What we see is that our tier one, tier two is actually flat and somewhat declining. And so the point you're making is already playing out.
Yeah.
And the question is like how we're coping about it. We're doing very good in terms of cementing our OEM relationships, making sure that we stay in tune with the local vehicle assemblers.
Yeah.
They get a very strong benefit from government to source locally produced components. And for that reason, we have an opportunity which the Chinese importers cannot fulfill because we are locally based, and therefore we get to sort of have a first option of our hands up. And so that's the one thing that we do.
Good. Welcome back. What else do we have to say about tires?
Well, yeah, you know, it's it's one of those things that the only time tires are like insurance, you know, the only time you notice it is when you need it.
Yes, yes.
It's kind of like otherwise they're just there.
Yeah.
You know, it's those four little rubber patches that attach your car to the ground, to the road, you know, and it's critically important.
And I'm sure some of the OEMs have considered making them optional extras as well. Oh, you want tires with that, sir? That'll be an extra.
100 grand. Oh, I'm with a steering wheel. Seats? You really want seats?
Oh, an engine? Don't be so demanding.
the list of optional extras drives me nuts. But yeah, I mean, you know, so it's part and parcel of the process. And what was interesting is the car review that we're going to talk about.
Yeah,
which is
nice segue.
A bit tricky. Didn't actually have Bridgestones on it. But yeah, the Lexus.
Yes. The anti-EV, as I call
it. GX 550. And,
this thing doesn't have a battery anywhere near it.
It has one to start a fairly significant and substantial engine on it.
Right, okay. How many litres?
It's a 2.5. Oh, let me get this right.
Not as guzzling as
it's a 3.5-litre turbocharged
V6. Oh, right. Okay.
So it produces something like 260 petrol. Kilowatts and, yes, lots of petrol.
Mm-hmm.
Many, many litres of petrol. And a gazillion newton meters, I think, almost 600. So it's one of these cars that is about as anti-EV as you can get. And I couldn't help when I was driving it. You know, it puts a smile on your face. It just does that. And I thought, how am I going to spin this past Duncan that we need to put this on the show? Watts and wheels. I'm going to say it's got a lot of kilowatts.
Okay.
It's got a lot of kilowatts.
There's electricity in there somewhere or somehow.
There's power. There's power in that thing. And yes, it is a little bit heavy on fuel. I mean, I got it down to around about 14.5 liters per 100 when I was feathering it.
14.5.
Yeah. Toyota, or Lexus claimed 12.8. So it's a little bit of a disparity there. But you know, it's a 2 million rand or 1.8 million rand vehicle. You know, the fuel bill is not really likely to move the needle too much on your lived experience with it. And the lived experience with it, I mean, as you'll see on the review, is I liked it.
What's it for? Is it for going really to Botswana?
Yes. Okay. Well, anything. You can go anywhere on it.
Yeah.
And there was one section of road out near Lydenburg that isn't road anymore. It's been absolutely and utterly destroyed by these double haul, double linkage ore carriers.
Is this up in the northwest?
Yeah.
Okay.
And when I say destroyed, it's not flattened. You've got little bits of tarmac left. You've got this moon landscape type thing. If you think, what was that movie with Bruce Willis? Armageddon, with that terrible asteroid.
Oh, that was terrible.
The surface of the asteroid is what that road looked like.
Okay.
It was so bad, I forgot to even take video on it. And I thought, well, we're in the Lexus 550. Let's see what this thing can do. And it was trundling down the road, and I was just working it out that the 4 to 10 k's an hour was able to achieve in this thing. First of all, there's no other car that could do that. The trucks were like, you know, looking at
it was
me like
just
I was
floating
going,
over the
like,
craters.
Like I was insane. What are you doing? No one comes onto this road. There's burned out hulks of dead things all over the, you know, previously lesser cars have died on that road.
Only thing going past them, Toyota minibus taxis.
Yeah, another Toyota badge on it. They weren't even there. So it was a horrendous road. And I just worked it out that if it had gone the full 40 k's, it would have taken us till the next morning to traverse it. So we bravely turned around and went the long way around back. But what a stunningly competent vehicle. Just amazing.
All right, well, let's stop talking about it and let's watch the documentary feature.
Good morning, folks. This is another episode of Watts and Wheels. This is a car review. Not the usual car review we do in Watts and Wheels, because we normally focus on NEVs. The car today is anything but an NEV. I will happily assuage your doubts as to what we're doing, that we lost our minds and our marbles in this review, because the topic of our show, or the title of our show, is Watts and Wheels, and this car's got a lot of watts. So let's focus on watts for a change, and let's see what it is the best of ICE is capable of producing as the EV, NEV landscape unfolds. We're talking today, of course, about the Lexus GX 550. This is brand spanking new. It is, if you can believe it, an entry-level Lexus off-road 4x4. And as you can see, judging by the number of bug splatters on this particular car, we've done quite a few kilometers in it. And judging by the blood spatter that's on the car these days, thank you all of you for driving your EVs, because it's obviously working. The insect populations are repopulating, and a couple of them unfortunately have met their end on the front of this handsome beast. I've deliberately not cleaned the vehicle for this shoot, just to show you we've done almost 1200 kilometers in this vehicle, and I can say that absolutely every single one of them was thoroughly enjoyable. Okay, we've opened the bonnet for you to see what it is that we're talking about when we're talking about all those lovely watts. And we have nothing less than a 3.5 liter petrol twin turbo V6. What does that mean? I said a lot of kilowatts, 260 of them to talk about, and 650 newton meters of torque, all mated to a 10 speed automatic box. Bog standard these days, and with a 2.5 ton vehicle, in fact this thing weighs in at around about just over 2,550 kilos, that is a lot of metal that is being lugged about by this absolute beast of an engine. The 260 kilowatts actually belies just how powerful this beast feels when you plant your foot into the plush leather carpeting that accosts you as part of the driver's accoutrements in this car. 3.5 liter V6 twin turbo, 2.5 tons. You're asking me, what is the fuel consumption on this vehicle? I can tell you that with a lot of open road driving, which is the majority of driving that we did on this road, some of it fairly spirited, one has to say, you get quite comfortable with the power quite quickly. I averaged, sit down, 14.1 litres per 100, a little bit off Lexus's claim of 12.3 litres per 100, but on a vehicle of this size and magnitude and at 1.8 million rand, the fuel bill is likely to be less of a concern for those of you able and happily able enough to be able to afford one of these things. And when you're in this seat, it's a lovely place to be, because as we'll see, it's vented and heated and automatic. And whilst I thought automatic for heated and vented seats sounded like a silly idea, Lexus are one step ahead of me. It's not a silly idea, it's brilliant, because you just don't even notice that you're being cooled or heated as you go along, and it really really works as a feature. I never thought I'd say that, but automatic heated and vented seats, it's a definite two thumbs up from me. Being a Lexus, they've done this once or twice before, and it is literally everything that's just forced to hand falls so easily on the steering wheel. You have a manual knob for your volume, which is great, because the stereo, the hi-fi I should actually call it, that comes with this car is second to none. It really kicks ass. It's clean, crisp pumps. You won't have any issues with the hi-fi that comes with the car. I'm going to turn it on just to show you that, of course, it automatically brings your seat forward and adjusts your steering position for you. The steering is electric. And if you haven't had electrically adjustable steering before, it's very hard to go back to not having electrically adjustable steering. It's just that good. You get the steering wheel in the absolute perfect position for you at any given time. Everything comes alive. The aircon turns on. You have manual knobs for the adjustment of your temperature, which sets everything. And the Lexus always just defaults to setting everything to auto. And one of these few occasions where the car is absolutely correct and it gets it right spot on. Wireless charging is here. And then we have my favorite thing in the whole world, a cool box, which says you shan't put nothing in it. I don't know what that sign means, but I presume it means you can only keep meat and fish in this particular thing. So I'm sorry about that, Lexus. I did keep my Coca-Cola in here. And we've only been driving for about 20 minutes. I can tell you already, this is absolutely crystal cold. It is cold as hell. So this little box really does work amazingly well. You can actually get 4 cool drinks in there and probably a fairly mid-sized trout, maybe a chop or a small steak. Other than that, your front touchscreen panel display is big and it's friendly. I think we can turn it on and turn the accessory light on. It'll give us the display as it boots up. this is definitely very high res. It's very bright, and bright enough to get around all the fingerprints that accumulate on these things as you go. I'm just going to turn the air conditioning down by just sliding like that. Of course, it's in auto, so it will do its own thing. And you have maps, you have your entertainment system, you have your phone, you have car stuff where you can set different things, and you have your setting menus where you can scroll through and do all your things. What's noticeable about these things is there's not 1,000 different menus to get to. If you want to get to something, you want to get to it fairly quickly. It's no more than 1 or 2 clicks to get to, for example, your head-up display, which of course is standard in the vehicle. And I find this kind of menu deceptively simple and easy to use. It was really an absolute pleasure to get to it. You, of course, in a Lexus have drive modes. So, of course, the full display is digital, which means you can customize it. You can have that as your display. You can have... Let me just go for... See if it'll scroll through without being on. It doesn't want to scroll through without being on, but what I wanted to show you is the different modes that you've got to drive this vehicle in. And interestingly enough, they have one called Eco. To be honest, comfort and normal would be enough for this vehicle, but it does have Sport S and Sport S Plus. And Sport S Plus and Sport S are quite dangerous modes, I've discovered and come to the conclusion in, because when you're in Sport S Plus, it changes the exhaust note. And it's not an annoying German shouty, very loud sports note. It's more sort of a subtle aggressive sports note in the exhaust. It just gives you a gentle rumble to remind you that you have 3.5 liters of petrol pulverizing power up front that delivers a satisfying raughtiness when one is plonking one's foot down and overtaking the minions that are next to you in the traffic. Or indeed, in our case, up in the Saabi area, overtaking trucks and things, having that kind of power on tap really does make a big difference. 1,000 Ks in this car yesterday. Yeah, I'm sorry, Lexus, we got lost. I'll tell you about that now. Sitting in the seats, did I adjust anything? Absolutely not. Did I get out? Yes. Did I feel stiff when I got out? Absolutely not. And one of the things I've always said about a super comfy seat is you just never notice them. And in this car, they are not noticeable. They're noticeable by the fact that they're not noticeable. They are that comfy. They really are some of the best seats I think I've ever sat in. So, other things noticeable about the Lexus that I have small niggles with. My niggle list is long, extensive, and unfortunately it's empty. I don't have any faults with this car. It's one of those that really everything has been thought about. There's nothing that you need to do. You just get in, point it in the direction you want to go, whatever direction that may be, and go. That's what this car's built to do. I'm not a fan of black rims, but I am a fan of those black rims. And funny enough, that was an observation made by one of the fellow members on this tour that I was on this weekend. In fact, it was a tour of the MG Car Club. I'm not allowed to say that, but I actually had to pay a fine at the car club for driving a car that none of them could afford, but that all of them wanted. And as I was saying earlier, these are 18-inch 265 70s. You can see this is a proper off-road tire. And it's enormous. And I think that's primarily because this is a 5-seater vehicle as opposed to a 7-seater, which you can have if you want to spend an extra 65 grand. You get some extra seats and a few other toys on the 550 model up on this. And to fit one's luggage and space in here, you can fit Granny and you can fit the dog. And pretty much, I don't know, if you run out of space on this, then you've got entirely too much luggage that you're taking with you on holiday. The tow hitch looks like it will tow, I don't know, pretty much a tank, and it is what it is. As far as tow hitches go, a fantastic piece of kit. You do, of course, have tow mode in the vehicle, so it knows when you've got a load on the back.
It looks big, William. It looks very big.
It is big. And, you know, what's interesting about it is that, you know, you're thinking, you know, it's a 2 million rand Lexus, 1.8 million rand Lexus, that, you know, it looks like a Lexus. Who's going to be interested in it? Every single place I stopped at.
Yeah, really?
People were like, is that the new Lexus?
Oh, really?
It was just one of those things.
You don't normally get that from Lexus.
Exactly. Yeah. And I was, have a look, you know, and really quite a draw card. It's quite a good looking vehicle. It's very boxy, and when you sit in it, you've got the windshield right here, and it's tiny windshield.
Okay,
you don't notice it because the rest of the car is just there's just so much space and
life. Does it feel like driving a tank?
It's cool. I want a tank. I really want a
just
tank.
Need a turret on top of the traffic.
I tell you, it gave me the sort of sensation I had when I drove that Volvo horse, the electric truck.
Oh yeah,
yeah. I drove that in the parking lot. That gives you a sense of like, I'm king of the world, not prince, king. You know,
I'm sure I'm not the only one, by the way, who has this fantasy of when sitting stuck in traffic on the N1.
Just drive
imagine
over.
I'm in a tank and I can just drive over the cars in front of me, or if someone pisses me off in the traffic, I can just swivel that turret and point at them.
Blow them away.
Or just point at them.
And make sure it has this ominous going, click. Something being loaded. It's like, you were saying? goodness me.
Right. Yeah. Good. Anyway. Looks like a fascinating car. Definitely not electric, and the rest of the cars we're going to do this season are going to be hybrid.
I'm wondering what Lexus might look like if they did make one that's electric.
That big.
That size, yeah. Mm-hmm. That could be quite entertaining.
Yeah.
I'm sure that's coming.
Probably need at least 200 kilowatt hours of battery.
Yeah, probably. Doesn't matter. The thing weighs 10 tons anyway. Yeah. It's kind of like, you know.
Anyway, we have these four buttons on the table for anyone who might have missed season zero. They do things. So I'm going to press them all and you're going to hear all these sounds that they make. This one's been specially programmed. I'll let you press that one. Prince.
That's the things that are rubbish.
That's the super uncool button. So
I noticed that. Yes. It did not escape my attention.
Don't blame me. That's the producer.
Meh.
That one, which is... Yeah.
Yeah.
Good. Cool. Nice.
Like.
We like it. And, of course, the super cool
button. You've got to have it, yeah.
Yeah. Yep. We did that last season, I think.
Yeah.
We picked that.
Yeah, no. And yeah, you're going to ask me where the Lexus goes, and I'm going to say it's between the blue and the purple.
Over here.
It's over there. The reason
I'll
why
have to
it's
measure both at the same time.
The reason why it's not a purple is just purely because it's not electric. But other than that, it is cool as hell.
Okay.
And fast. It's quick.
It's quite an endorsement. So we need to chat about. Right, you're going to have to do this one. The Dolphin Surf. Where would you put that?
You know, based on the fact that it's the first sub 400k EV, that it's exactly where it needs to be in our market. It's the class leading EV to get EV to the masses. It's got to be
super cool.
Wow. It's got to be super cool. Mm-hmm. And backed up by the fact we've got 300 chargers coming to support it.
Press it a few more
good
times.
Good job, BYD. We like it.
All right. BYD is getting a lot of attention in this episode because the next car is the BYD C-Lion 5. Now, I have not driven this thing. I've only read the articles about it and read the specs. But it looks impressive. It's like a slightly cheaper version of the C-Lion 6 plug-in hybrid electric vehicle. I suspect the battery's a bit smaller, although I'm not sure about that. But it's a decent-looking car. It's difficult to – maybe we shouldn't even press the button.
Well, give us one to drive.
I'm kind of hovering over here on the spec.
Okay.
But so I'm not going to press it.
I haven't driven it.
And the other one we haven't driven yet, so maybe we shouldn't press the buttons either. But we can talk about it. It's the Volvo EX60.
Nice.
Now, this sounds like an interesting car.
So that's the new electric, bigger version of the EX40. Well, the basically just the Volvo.
Yeah, it's an EX, so isn't it?
It's an EX.
The EX30 and the EX90 they have.
Correct. And then you've got the
XC40.
Correct, which is the electric. Yes. You get that in a single or twin. And the twin is just stupidly eye-bleedingly fast.
Beautiful,
it's fantastic.
Car. Beautiful
lovely,
car.
Lovely, lovely vehicle. And now you've got the X60, which is the bigger version of that. Now, interestingly, in the petrol versions of Volvos, it's not the 40 you would buy. You would actually just buy the 60. It's 100 grand more, and it's a much bigger, more appointed car than the 40.
That's a 40.
In the petrol derivatives of it. In the electrics, EX60, yes, I haven't driven it, but somehow I missed the launch invite, but you know, obviously it was an oversight by Volvo. it's I think it's going to be one of those that's when you're in that level of EV market, I think the EX60 is probably going to be the one that now outsells the XC40.
I think so, because
you're getting a bigger vehicle at the end of the day. I did drive the EX90 down in Hermanus with the EV show, and that's also, I mean, it's a stunning
boat on wheels.
It's a beautiful boat. It's
beautiful, but it's full of tech.
And it's just alarmingly fast. Alarmingly fast.
And for something that size and heavy.
Comfortable. It's just a lovely motor.
Beautiful. So I think we'll move on to our next segment, and that's our interview of the week. And you had a chat with Andrew Kirby, no less. The CEO of Toyota South Africa.
Andrew Kirby is one of those really cool CEOs. He just willingly gives of his time, and he had to give it to me twice because there was a microphone hiccup. Mm-hmm. A technological challenge between myself, the microphones, and the camera. But nonetheless, he graciously conceded to give me another 20 minutes of his valuable time to chat and shoot the bruise about where Toyota find themselves with the OEM battles. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those interviews that I think everybody needs to actually listen to.
Right.
And when I say listen to, don't listen to me. Listen to what Andrew Kirby is saying. Mm-hmm. Because what he says carries weight. And I don't want to say he speaks for the entire OEM industry in South Africa, but he speaks for Toyota of it. I don't want to call him Mr. 1% because Toyota is more than 1% of our total economy. Mm-hmm.
A total economy.
Total economy.
Wow.
So what happens with Toyota is significant. Mm-hmm. And there's
a Are you huge, about to make me depressed again?
No. Mm-hmm. There's a huge amount. In fact, Andrew's one of those guys that generally makes you feel better.
Okay.
He's Mr. Fix Everything, make you feel good.
Even as the asteroid approaches.
Don't look up. I love talking to him because he's always forthright and he's absolutely honest, and sometimes brutally so, as you'll hear in the interview.
All right, let's go and have a listen to Andrew Kirby.
So, at Watson Wheels, at Watson Wheels, like I said yesterday, we bring out the heavyweights of the industry, and there's no heavier hitter than Mr. Andrew Kirby, CEO and President of Toyota SA. Andrew, we kicked off this NAMSA event, and I found myself, just speaking for me, a little frustrated at the fact that we seem to be rehashing the same old themes. We need policy on EV, we need policy on APDP2, and it's urgent, it needs speed, it's urgent, it needs speed, and this year seems to be a repetition of the same. Are we making progress on this front?
I think it's difficult to say. There's certainly a lot more clarity and a lot more alignment around what the key issues are. And I think as this trend has now become a lot more clearer, the targeted interventions are very clear, and at least the discussion is more aligned than we've seen before. What's difficult for us to be able to forecast, though, is how quickly that's going to translate into, you know, visible action. There's a lot we need to do as industry. I mean, we need to take it on the shoulder and also make sure that we adapt very quickly.
Sure.
But we know that without specific interventions around NEVs, for example, we're not suddenly going to see the country adopt NEVs at pace. And that's what we need to be able to justify investments in those products. So I think the jury's out, to be quite honest. Discussions have been good. I think this year we've seen far more rigorous discussion, a lot more data behind the priorities, and very, very concrete, specific recommendations. We're just going to have to keep having these discussions and get to a point where we can hopefully see some policy interventions.
So just for our readers, we just jumped into the deep end there. It's what I do, you know, it just happens. And I call them readers, not viewers. You can see this is something that's a work in progress, much like government policy, it would appear. And if I can use Toyota as an example, for instance, you manufacture shedload of vehicles locally. Mm. Export 67% of them?
No, roughly 50%, actually.
50%, okay. Yeah. So half of what you actually produce...
Produce, we export.
...goes overseas. Yeah. And the 67%, I think, even more of that, is going to two markets.
Right.
UK
and Europe.
And EU.
Yes.
And we know that in 2035, there's a hard stop on ICE.
Yes.
Which is what you make.
Yes.
So you need to transition to NEVs fairly rapidly by 2035 to be able to continue to supply those markets.
Yes.
And if you don't?
Yeah, so there are two really important things. Of course, we need to transition to hybrid plug-in hybrid BEV to be able to sustain our really large volume of exports into Europe. And we're not alone. And most of the OEMs are in that position. But we also need the South African domestic market to transition to NEVs so that we can take that volume plus the export volumes to justify the investments.
Yes.
There is another side of this. If I were to, for example, suddenly start building BEVs, I wouldn't be able to sell many. So what we're dealing with is getting the timing right. We're seeing some big technology step changes. A lot of the step changes are actually taking longer than was originally predicted. The costs are actually still quite high. But the question becomes, at what point do you make and you take that risk? And given the fact that we would typically decide 3 to 4 years before we start production.
That's exactly.
And then we've got a 7 to 10 year model life cycle. So being able to accurately forecast that trend change is really important. And at the same time, how do we make sure that that's a viable investment? Because if we make a wrong call on something as significant as that, it can have disastrous consequences for us, including job losses. So all is not lost. We've got time over the next 10 years, but that time's getting really tight. Because 3 years' time already takes us to 2028.
Correct.
So that's where the pressure is on, and we have a view of where the European market and where the South African market will be by 2028, and think that the technology step changes will be sufficient for us to really be able to produce vehicles that have mass adoption. And I think that's the critical nature of these discussions.
It's a very difficult thing to try and predict what your customers are going to be wanting, because you need to give it to them when they're going to want it. But you need to make that decision 3 years ago. So
yes,
it's ultimate in crystal ball gazing, isn't it?
But I think we have a fairly good view of what our customers want.
Sure.
We
want them now.
Yes, but it's what's the price point that we're going to be able to achieve? And that's the difficulty.
So there was a lot of talk in this particular Lancer SA Auto Week around the fact that brand loyalty is no longer a thing and affordability is everything. And in my mind, I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, well, I think that's the biggest load of bollocks I've ever heard in my life. I think it's rubbish. I think affordability drives brand loyalty because... affordability on a vehicle, we're talking 300,000 rand investment on average, possibly more, is a huge quantity of change for anybody making an investment in a car. Mm. And you're going to be doing that over the over the lifespan of the vehicle, which is 5 to 10, however long it is. So I think that will drive careful consideration of placement of one's money rather than this seemingly flippant, we don't have brand loyalty, we're just going to buy the cheapest we can find. Because I think the one thing Toyota specifically has gotten right is that cheap upfront does not necessarily mean lower total cost of ownership. Do you see brand loyalty eroding for Toyota or strengthening?
No, I think it's strengthening. I think we measure our retention values very, very closely. And even with this proliferation of new imports and a variety of choice, we've been able to steadily improve that. So that's key. I mean, looking after our customers, responding very quickly to any issues that arise, but also to their needs, is what keeps us grounded, and that has to be our key priority. I do think, though, that especially younger customers that are struggling with that monthly repayment, they are fairly quick to choose something that on the surface is initially a lot cheaper. But as you said, what comes with the experience of owning a car is starting to recognize what is that real cost of ownership over the lifetime, but also what's the resale value.
Well,
and you know, you tend to make that mistake maybe once, but you won't make it twice.
No.
So that does mean that customers that are a little bit more mature and have had more ownership experiences start to keep that in a better balance.
I'm with you. I don't want to say that I'm of the fuddy-duddy generation, but I don't understand what Gen Z's or Gen Y's or any Gen's are. I guess I'm in that space. Competition for Toyota South Africa, we touched on it yesterday, was, you mentioned that I saw it as being Morocco as eating South Africa's pie. And you pointed out the fact that actually Thailand is increasingly becoming a bigger problem for specifically you guys in terms of the fact that they're becoming more competitive in the same markets that Toyota South Africa competes with. So you're up against all the other competition plus what other Toyota plants around the world are capable of doing.
Mm.
Where's that panning out?
Sure. So when we look at getting decisions to manufacture vehicles in South Africa, our competition is other countries that produce similar vehicles. And if we look at Hilux, Fortuner, certainly Thailand is our main benchmark. And we need to be able to prove that we can be more competitive than Thailand if we're going to be exporting. So to be able to get export contracts, that's a key issue for us, and we at the moment are not competing with Morocco at all. I do think, though, with the advent of the African Trade Free Trade Agreement, we will see Morocco starting to switch to trying to supply the rest of Africa. And that's where we would have some concerns. How do we make sure that we still the majority manufacturing base in Africa?
On that topic, I mean, the whole of Africa, a new vehicle market is something like 1.1 million.
That's very small.
So we're talking Nigeria buys 12,000 new cars.
Yeah, it's very small.
A year.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Is it enough to move the needle for you?
So this is where I think decisions around the future are really important. So we think that Africa, and I think most people would agree, will be the fastest growing new car market in the world. Right. And there are a couple of reasons for it. Motorization levels. So vehicle ownership per capita is very low in Africa.
Yes.
Population size is large.
Yes.
It'll overtake China in the next 10 years. And infrastructure investments, FDI into Africa, is significant. And we see different countries progressing at different speeds, sometimes taking a couple of steps back. But overall, we're going to see the slow, moderate growth of new car sales and vehicle ownership. What's hamstringing vehicle sales in Africa is the importation of used vehicles. And we try to, especially through the AAAM, influence and support countries with what their policies look like. And instead of just importing used vehicles, thinking about how they can grow a new car market and even have some form of industrialization. So I think to answer your question, yes, right now the market's not that substantial. Could, in the next 5 years, our exports as Toyota South Africa into Africa exceed that of Europe? Potentially.
Really?
Mm.
Wow.
Mm.
Okay, so that changes the game
a little bit.
Quite significantly.
Yeah.
Before we chatted in this interview, I asked you to think about this concept called peak auto.
Mm.
And that's where the world is at a finite, fixed limit production of vehicles.
Mm.
Do you buy into that philosophy at all, or is it anything that's
across
your radar? Is it?
I haven't looked into a lot of detail, but I think it's one of these unique situations that places Africa and South Africa in a very advantageous position.
It does,
because Africa is the one continent where that's not going to happen. So whether there's some slight movements on that peak auto total volume of 90 to 100 million vehicles per year, the question is that in Africa that's going to be double or triple. So we know we're going to be moving in the right direction. But if we just sit back and say, well, that's fine, then the rest of the countries around the world can import into Africa, we're going to lose out. So how do we become suppliers of our own products? Manufacture what we want as ourselves as opposed to just being consumers.
And Ethiopia banning ICE vehicles completely. Bang, done. Finished. Did anyone see that coming?
Yeah, it was discussed, and I think one has to just understand their economic environment as well. They're struggling with foreign exchange availability, not really able to export enough tobacco.
Yeah.
So, you know, it looks a little bit on the surface like it's a short-term measure to manage their own forex.
Okay.
So I don't think it's necessarily sustainable. But I think many African countries are going to try and see how they can leapfrog and go directly into NEVs without going the ICE route. And that's going to be problematic for us because it comes down to affordability.
And we still need to make NEVs to be able to supply them should they go that route.
Yes, exactly.
The interesting thing, I sat in an AMSA event a couple of weeks ago where a representative from the Norwegian government was present. And the question was posed by a colleague, obviously far more well-versed in asking questions than I, because I didn't come up with it and I regret it. But the question was asked to her is, what did the Norwegian government do to incentivize the incredible uptake of EVs that they see in Norway that has surpassed the world? What were the steps that the government took to educate their population so rapidly and so quickly? And the answer came back was one of those ta-da moments. All the Norwegian government did was they said, dear customer, here's the price of an ICE vehicle, and here's the price of an EV vehicle, and the two are exactly the same. You can choose which one you want. And because the costs of running an EV are lower, your maintenance costs are lower, your fuel costs are lower, your total cost of ownership of EV are lower, the richest country in the world opted for the cheaper solution.
It's a nice way of saying that what they did is created a penalty system.
Well, they subsidized it, whatever they did to get us to that point.
Yeah, yeah.
And the customers, not knowing what had happened in the background, chose the cheaper option.
Yeah,
so it tells me economics, even in the richest country in the world, for the consumer's point of view, rule the roost.
Absolutely. And if I can just share an example. Croda Cross, we brought it in 2021. We launched a hybrid in volume. It was a big step for us. There were almost no NEV sales in South Africa, and we had anticipated we could be fairly aggressive and get to around 15% mix. We launched the car and there was over 50% adoption
straight away,
right? And we have been able to find over time that price point of the premium of the hybrid over the equivalent ICE engine is very sensitive. South Africa's customers, they know when it's too expensive or when it really makes good sense. Mm. And I don't think that there is any resistance from South African consumers. They are very happy to adopt the new technology. If I could get the right pricing on Corolla Cross, I could sell 100% hybrids. I think everybody would be very happy. 100%. It's a better drive. It's fantastic fuel consumption, low emissions. And you can drive, you know, with zero sound when you want to. So the same is true for plug-in hybrid. When it comes to BEVs, that's a little bit different because now you're talking about infrastructure issues, range anxieties, etc. But the challenge is not so much convincing customers of the new technology. The challenge is bringing it in at the right value.
100%.
It's all about value and price.
So why is it that our government is so obstinate about our ad valorem on EVs? What do you think is the hold up here? Because every other country that's adopted NEVs and said that they want to adopt the new technology has offered incentives on these vehicles. And yet we penalize EV owners with, I think it's an extra 7% over and above. Help it make sense to me, because it doesn't.
No, and I'm not sure what the resistance is. Treasury is obviously responsible for ad valorem and the governance around it. And, you know, as I've explained before, they haven't moved the curve since 1995.
That's on all cars.
On all cars, right?
So what we're paying is as a luxury vehicle, 1995, right. We're now paying on a Toyota Vitz.
On an entry level. So it doesn't make any sense. And it certainly doesn't make sense if we're going to put that same tax on a locally made vehicle, because yes. you're not helping to create the local demand. I think that government's in a position, or Treasury is in a position, where they haven't been able to convince themselves of the fiscal benefits.
Mm.
And whilst it might be very clear what the benefits are for the country, there seem to be some fiscal challenges. And I think that's the only reason I can think of.
We need to educate them.
And come up with convincing arguments about why it really does make sense fiscally. Yeah. Yeah.
Next task for NAMSA then.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Andrew, let's leave it there. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks,
William. I appreciate it enormously.
Thank you very much.
Always good talking to you.
Thank you. You too. Thank you.
So, interesting chat with Andrew. Did he mention anything about their new electric cars?
We didn't have a chance to get to that. Afterwards, we were talking about, you know, just why one should go out and buy one of these new Lexus, because he's actually got one in his garage. He quite likes it. I was like, I could see why. Obviously, I said, you have to like it, but he's like, no, I don't have to. I really do.
Okay.
But yeah, it's certainly the most closely guarded secret in South Africa, but that Toyota bringing finally some EVs to mm-hmm. to the side.
Three models, I believe.
They say they're bringing three, so it's going to be the BZ4X.
BZ4X.
Did I get that right?
Probably, yeah, I suppose Japanese would pronounce it Z.
There's a video clip on our there's a video clip on our new TikTok channel of it mm-hmm. down in NAMSA. Pricing is yet to be determined, but it's not going to be cheap.
What do you think it's going to cost, roughly?
They're talking between 900 and a bar.
Okay.
So it's up there. Have a look at the video. It is not a typical Toyota in terms of being plaid, standard, somewhat boring.
Mm.
It's not that.
It's exciting.
It's a lovely looking vehicle.
What is it? An SUV? Or?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it's an SUV. Sort of crossover SUV type mm-hmm. thing. And the interior on it just looks spectacular. Without yeah. being cluttered, it looks fantastic. And they're little tweaks on the outside that I really do like.
Mm. Why has it got such a strange name? BZ4X.
I don't know.
Certainly not memorable.
I think once you start to see them on the road, everyone's going to know BZ4X thing, you know. There'll be a reason why they named it that. I'm sure they'll let us know at launch what it is. The other one, I think yeah. now we speculate is going to be probably an electric Corolla type thing.
That makes sense.
And I think that's going to be sort of roundabout, hopefully targeting pricing of Corolla Cross, I'm hoping.
600K?
Between 400 and 600. I'm okay. hoping to span that sort of range.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with a Toyota badge on it. That should do well.
Yeah.
That should do well.
Like, Toyota is so trusted by South African car buyers that they introduce electric, they almost kind of define the market.
Well, you know, I said I was at one of their launches, and I was saying, you know, I actually got a comment on LinkedIn from someone who's saying, you know, well, why don't we just, you know, make Toyota go global as a South African company?
Mm.
Mm-hmm. It's like, so we have South Africans that believe Toyota is a South African company. You can't sing higher praise than that for a company. And I think the third one they're going to bring, I suspect, is going to actually be an electric Lexus. Maybe a big SUV type thing.
Okay.
I think, I don't know, but it's a what the hell? If I'm right, I'm right. If I'm wrong.
Yeah,
it's just a guess.
Yeah, but maybe they do a Corolla Cross version of it as well. Maybe.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. You know, so.
But exciting times, and these all three models are supposedly coming in 2026.
Correct, first quarter. So soon.
It'll be fascinating.
Soon,
electric cars from Toyota in this market.
I shall
make a splash.
I shall put my feelers out at the next event and start to sort of tap shoulders and say, put the mic under the nose and say, what's coming? And one day it'll work and someone will say, oh, and they let it slip, but it hasn't yet.
Keep trying.
We'll keep trying.
And that is all we have for episode one of
What's been Full
Wheels. It's been
jam-packed.
A full episode, yeah. So no shortage of stuff to talk about. And looking at episodes two, show notes in front of me here.
We got a lot to go through.
A lot to go through still. So
Duncan's been fun. I'm so looking forward to, like, more and more and more of these.
Absolutely. It's lovely to talk about cars. Wheels at techcentral.co.za is the email address if you want to send them William hate mail.
Just address it Prince William.
Yes, of course. His Royal Highness.
His Royal Highness. Then I know it's hate mail. I can delete it.
Until episode 2, safe motoring. Thanks, guys.